Museum of the Moving Image welcomes you to the Pinewood Dialogues Online, an archive of conversations with innovative creative figures in film, television, and digital media. Visit Museum of the Moving Image in New York City or online at www.movingimage.us.
Good evening and welcome. New York's film culture is influential and vibrant. It is also a small, tight-knit world. Tonight's audience are a prime example, a cross-section of the city's best filmmakers, critics, editors, distributors, publicists, film programmers, and of course the hippest and most sophisticated people, the Museum of the Moving Image members. Okay, I knew that. The biggest applause so far. We're here tonight to honor somebody who has played a vital role in film culture for the past 30 years. His tenure at the Village Voice is longer than any other critic in the paper's history, including another kid who grew up in Queens, Andrew Saras. And he is the most perceptive, informed, insightful film critic around, an articulate champion of neglected and overlooked films, as well as an incisive analyst who can dig deep beneath the surface of Hollywood glitz and view a blockbuster movie as a cultural artifact. He understands the link between politics and entertainment better than anyone since Ronald Reagan and Arnold Schwarzenegger. And he is, of course, the Village Voice senior film critic, Jim Hoberman. So to celebrate Jim, I wrote a top 10 list for the year, the top 10 things about Jim Hoberman that we like as a film critic. One, he does great top 10 lists. His list has always been an interesting mix. They've included a Madonna music video, a Carl Stalling CD with music from Looney Tunes cartoons, and my favorite, Game 6 of the 1986 World Series. And famously, his lists have always been eclectic. In 1979, Vivian Dick's Super 8 punk movie, She Had Her Gun Already, was ranked just below... just below... Always a cheap applause line. The Vivian Dick reference. Was ranked just below Francis Ford Coppola's Apocalypse Now. A favorite Village Voice tradition was the annual letter of complaint to the Village Voice editor about how elitist and egg-headed Hoberman's top 10 list was. And, of course, this letter always came from a Village Voice staff member. Jim is always number two. Jim has been the most important critical champion of avant-garde cinema. He's a longtime champion of filmmakers like Ernie Gare and Ken Jacobs, who have both been on the top 10 list a number of times, and both are here tonight. Jim is a great film programmer. He has organized a number of retrospectives here at the museum, including one on Vietnam-era Westerns, a great series on the underground legend Jack Smith, and a series based on his book, The Dream Life. In fact, he often uses his space in the Village Voice as a form of programming, picking two or three films to analyze in a week that have interesting, sometimes unexpected connections. Number four, Jim has great taste. Two words, David Cronenberg. Who is one of the very few mainstream filmmakers as intelligent as Jim Hoberman. Number five, Jim is the rare film critic whose references are not primarily to other movies, but to a remarkable range of cultural sources. His recent review of Todd Haynes' I'm Not There is a worthy companion to the film, an encyclopedic survey of the 1960s with references to literature, photography, art, music, and much more. Number six, Jim writes great books. Looking at his bibliography, Bridge of Light, Yiddish film Between Two Worlds, The Red Atlantis, Communist Culture in the Absence of Communism, The Dream Life, Movies, Media, and the Mythology of the 60s, it becomes clear that Jim's subject is not just film, but like the museum, I think, he treats the moving image as an artifact with which to explore the history of the 20th century and the present. Number seven, Jim doesn't mind being an intellectual. There has been a long anti-intellectual streak in American culture. Critics, including film critics, who were dismissive of movies that asked the audience to think as though emotion and intellect couldn't coexist, either on screen or in the mind of the reader. Jim is an anti-intellectual. Number eight, Jim has complex responses to complex films. He's able to point his thumb up and down in the same review, and sometimes that's the right response. Number nine, Jim is funny. His humor can be as deadpan as Jim Jarmusch's films, but he is the wittiest film writer around. And finally, number 10 is the J. His name is Jim, but he's always gone by J in print. I think that when he wrote a piece defending the movie Shoah from Pauline Kael's bashing in The New Yorker, an irate and probably anti-Semitic reader ominously wrote a letter to the editor stating, "We know what the J stands for." Well, well, we know what the J really stands for. It stands for genius. So now, I'm not going to be the one introducing Jim. I'm going to now introduce another critic who goes by his initials, A.O. Scott. And I just want to say that he's been a great critic since he joined the New York Times in 2000, just 8 years ago. So he's going to have to wait 22 years for his tribute here. In 22 years. But I think anybody who's been reading the New York Times knows that it's a very vibrant time for that section, with Tony and with Mindola Dargis, who was a student of Jim's. The paper has incredibly lively writing. And anyhow, who would have thought that we'd have the day where we have the brash young upstart critic from the New York Times in conversation with the establishment figure at the Village Voice? But here he is, A.O. Scott.
Thank you. I'm going to take my seat in just a minute. I'm not Jim Hoberman, although once in the press mailbox area at the Cannes Film Festival, Jim was mistaken for me, which I've always been very flattered by. I don't know how Jim feels about it. But I know there are a lot of our fellow critics in the audience here tonight, and I know that I'm not alone, and I can venture to speak for most, if not all of us, to say that there's perhaps no other active film critic who has taught as much by example and by precept about how to think seriously, clearly, coherently, and bravely about film, and how to write about film week in, week out, and also at greater length with such concision and intellectual command and wit as Jim. So I will bring him up to the stage now, and we will talk about the last 30 years. I think we'll take it year by year. So settle in.
I feel like I'm a very tough act to follow.
If you don't mind, I thought I would start by reading some of your own words to you. asking you to defend them. No. Yes. I was struck. In preparation for this night, I was doing what I often do anyway, which was reading around in your work and the work of other critics I admire. And I found what might be my favorite single essay of yours, and certainly the one that I come back to again and again, because I think there's still a lot to be learned from it, an essay called The Film Critic of Tomorrow Today, which is both looking back at and referring to an essay by Rudolf Arnheim called The Film Critic of the Future that was written in the 1930s. And that is responding in the middle of the 1990s to all kinds of then kind of current ideas about the death of cinema and the death of cinephilia and so on. But I just wanted to read the very last passage from this essay, because I think it's something that I come back to as a challenge and a provocation and an ideal again and again. You begin quoting Jean-Luc Godard, "The greatest history is the history of the cinema." And then you say, "That history will force those critics refusing the role of underpaid cheerleaders to themselves become historians, not to mention archivists, bricoleurs, spoil sports, pundits, entrepreneurs, anti-conglomerate guerrilla fighters, and in general, masters of what is known in the Enchanted Palace as counter-programming." So I wondered if we could start out, just if you could talk a little bit about the idea of the critical dilemma almost that you describe here of being either cheerleader or all of these other things, and how you see in your, you know, from day to day, from week to week, these different roles pushing themselves on you.
Okay. Can I take a look?
Sure.
Well, I would say, first of all, that there's this thing called film culture, not the magazine, but something that would be akin to literature, and without being unduly weighty about it. That's what I think that that's the entity that I feel that film critics and other interested parties serve. It's it's making film culture, and I think to do that you have to be aware of what is coming at you, being propelled at you by the studios and the marketplace, and also have a kind of context to counter that with and to make sense of it, which is the history of film, and also to a degree the potential, the possibilities of it. And so this is why I like the idea of double bills and programming films, because that automatically puts something in context.
I wonder if we could. I wanted to read that partly to begin by going backwards. I mean, we're here celebrating 30 years of your writing for The Village Voice, and 30 years ago, the state of film culture was perhaps rather different from what it is today. And is also, I think, that moment that we're talking about, the late 70s, is very much mythologized time. There's the mythology of what was happening in the cinema itself, particularly the American cinema. That's the moment, or perhaps the beginning of the ebb of the new Hollywood and the American new wave, or Hollywood auteurism, or whatever you could call it. Also, when you arrived on the scene, there were some very imposing figures on the critical landscape, which are also looked back on now with a lot of sort of nostalgia and fear and trembling. So, I mean, can you describe, to come into the house of one of those giants,
to sneak in,
how you found the world then?
Well, I think that this was sort of the end, I would say, the tail end, maybe the bitter end of this mythologized period of the that began, I would say, in the late 50s, and then kind of, let's say, petered out with the bicentennial, when so many things seem to go wrong. But so I came after that, and there were some things in the landscape that definitely were better. I mean, one very simply was that there were more venues, at least print venues, for people to write film criticism. And there also were, in New York, more venues, I think, where movies could be shown, at least revival theaters and so on. But I also think at that time that there was a lot of stuff, and I think this is true today, although less so, that there were many things that were just not being written about. So I was very fortunate when I came to The Voice in that I could do, pretty much whatever I wanted, as long as the other two critics, that was Andrew Saris and Tom Allen, who was quite an interesting critic in his own right, weren't interested in. And that covered a lot of material. And so, I was able to put things together, assemble a whole kind of beat, and so that was great. That was very liberating, in a way. I mean, there were many things. I got to review, for just one example, Celine and Julie Go Boating. This legendary movie that drifted into New York, didn't even run a whole week. It got pulled out of the theater. I think maybe even before my review came out, but I consider that an amazing opportunity, to be able to write about something like that.
And you also wrote quite a bit about experimental films, and also about a phenomenon which I'm not sure exists anymore in film culture in quite the same way, which is the sort of the cult film, these sort of, I don't even know how to describe them quite, but these sort of disreputable cinematic artifacts that would surface here and there.
Yeah. Well, Jonathan Rosenbaum and I had the Jonathan at that time was the critic for the Soho Weekly News, So we had the great good fortune to be approached by a publisher who sort of thought, oh, isn't there something in these midnight movies, you know, and given an opportunity to investigate mm-hmm. that. And what was apparent then was that it was just ending, which is always and from a historical point of view the best time to write about it, so that we saw the whole shape of how that was going. So there were a lot of things that changed with the development of the VCR. I'm not a Luddite. I mean, I teach, and stuff is shown on we show stuff digitally on tape all the time. So I don't think that's necessarily bad, but that did change film culture and the way that people looked at movies very dramatically in the early 80s.
Can you talk a little bit more about that? Was it just a matter of how people were experiencing or receiving? I mean, was it just a matter of where the audience was in relation to what it was looking at? Or do you think this also... How did this correlate to changes in the kind of stuff that was being made?
Well, I think that the most obvious one was that the end of revival houses for the most part, or the decline of revival houses. I mean, there are still some in New York. I mean, there's Film Forum, which is an incredible revival theater in part, and they're the Museum of the Moving Image and Museum of Modern Art and Walter. I mean, there are places that show old movies, but it was a more of an ongoing commercial potential to go to a movie theater and see a movie, and once things became available, otherwise it kind of my feeling is that these theaters were themselves not huge money makers ever, mm-hmm. and we're sort of marginal, but this meant the end of their economic viability. And the thing with those theaters is that they also constituted social environments. I mean, I remember there being a discussion around this time. Somebody pointed out that, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong with this, that didn't Lenin say that the way to make a revolution, let's make a newspaper, right? The way to make a revolution, make a newspaper. So right. There was this, well, make a movie theater, and that way you have, people coming, like-minded people coming, seeing these things. And that's basically how I think the cult movies mm-hmm. were made. I mean, I think it depended on this shared apprehension of a movie and a shared discovery. And, coincidentally, it's certainly a coincidence that I treasure, the first movie I reviewed for The Voice was Eraserhead, which was precisely in that situation. I mean, showing at midnight at the old Cinema Village before it was divided into a number of theaters. Cinema Village had a sort of history. That's where I think Pink Flamingos had developed as a cult film. And Richard Goldstein, who was the arts editor at the time and who was the guy who hired me, said, oh, yeah, there's some movie, something that's opening there. Go there at midnight. Go write about it. Because of the whole purpose of a movie like that, it wasn't open for review. It just showed up at midnight and depended on word of mouth. And that's something that I think has to do again with the social, the fact that people would come out at midnight,
right,
for this experience.
Yeah. Now I wonder how this has changed, because this is, I was, I guess I'm young enough to have missed most of that, and old enough to have caught the tail end of it, having seen Eraserhead like in a midnight revival a few years later in the town that I was living in at sort of the pot smokers theater with the couches and the broken espresso machine, but which was a social situation of its own. But I've been thinking about this in terms of your own way of writing as a critic, which is as someone who writes with a great consciousness of history, of both of film history and the social history, say, in which it's embedded. But also, it's always been partly the history, I think, or at least the post-war history of American film criticism, involves discovering these things in the past that had been overlooked or rejected, and also at the same time, the lifting up into aesthetic appreciation of things that had been, disreputable, or which goes all the way back to the discovery that the classic Hollywood was actually classic, not just junk. And I guess my question is, what happens when these discoveries and these historical reclamation projects become something that's institutionalized? Because you talk about Eraserhead, and you sort of look at, you know, David Lynch, while he's still a very, in a way, you know, one of the last kind of cussedly independent filmmakers out there, is a canonical figure for a lot of critics. Pink Flamingos is part of the 25th anniversary box set, or the 40th anniversary box set, that a lot of critics got from New Line Cinema, along with Lord of the Rings and The Wedding Crasher. So, I mean, in a way, what you're talking about, I think when people talk about the decline or obsolescence of a certain kind of film culture is also its institutionalization.
Yeah, I think that. Well, okay. There's many paths to take from this. I mean, first of all, I think that there's a dynamic which existed from the very beginning, in which passé films were rediscovered very often by artists or artistic types, you know, aesthetes, and were valued. And you know, the French, the reorganization of American cinema, well, let's say the rationalization of it, you know, by that the French engaged in the 50s, and then which Andrew Saris really brought to America in the 60s, is you know, part of an ongoing process. I mean, you know, the surrealists and other artists were championing Feuillade in the 20s. You know, when these movies were regarded as junk and old fashioned and so on. And I just think that, you know, that there's a way in which the archaic can be turned into the avant garde. I'm more concerned in a way about, I would say, academic filmmaking, and I'm a sort of an academic, so I don't mean to make that sound like a pejorative term. But, you know, filmmaking formula, a certain kind of formulaic filmmaking, rather than people's perception becoming academic. Because I think that as I say, a lot of stuff works in terms of context. And I did, you know, I was an undergraduate at probably the very moment when film studies were you know, getting into the university. And again, I was very fortunate, you know, to study film at that time at the with Ken Jacobs at the State University of New York and others. And it was a very freewheeling moment when all sorts of things were put together. But even before that, you know, when I was in high school in New York, it was possible to go see, you know, The Birth of a Nation at the Museum of Modern Art, and then go and see the new Godard film the next day or even that day, and all these things were in a way contemporary. Mm-hmm. So I think that there's that too. And then finally, even though I'll contradict what I said before, there still can be cult films in a way, because Donnie Darko is an example of that. I mean, that's a movie that was not particularly well received at Sundance, that got mixed and not all that enthusiastic reviews when it opened in New York, and then ran for 2 years or something at the Pioneer Theater at midnight. Right. So it was made by the audience.
You used the phrase academic filmmaking before, and I wonder if you could expand a little bit on what you mean by that. Because when I hear you say that, I think about a kind of a, you know, in the sense that you would talk about academic painting of you know, of the 19th century, that is a sort of, you know, work in a received style that is sort of content to stay within its own within its own parameters. I mean, where do you see that?
Well, I think you see a lot of, we don't even need to talk about, you know, stuff that's produced by the studios, because it's a given that you know that commercial films need formulas, and sometimes that can be great, depending on who's, you know, what people do with it. But that, you know, anything that made money once is just assumed to be able to be recycled to make money again. That's sort of the principle of it. But, you know, a movie like, you know, it's actually one of the, I would say, one of the best received movies of the year. No Country.
Yeah.
for Old Men to me is a very academic film. I mean, that is, you know, constructed in such and such a way to like to bring the audience along and deliver a certain amount of thrills and excitement and surprises on schedule, and you know has a very mechanical aspect. But I couldn't deny that it's an extremely well made movie. The way that the you know French academic painting is
right,
you know,
right.
Is expert.
Well, yeah, I mean that was sort of what I thought you. I mean a lot of what goes out under the label of independent now, when that's sort of lazily applied, which I tend to think of more as you know the studio specialty division Oscar movie is I think can be called an academic style. Although there are examples of very good work within it.
Another,
Although you know you could just to maybe play devil's advocate. There's a sense in which you could apply that description to your favorite movie of this year, I'm Not There. In that it's a movie that I admire very, very much too, which has in a very specific sense an academic pedigree, you know, in the Brown Semiotics Department. Mm-hmm. But also comes out of an engagement with other work and other texts. I mean, it is in a way. I mean, and I think this is what I like about it. Mm-hmm. It is in a way a work of commentary.
Yeah, I would say that's academic in a good way. But I I see what you're saying, but I would say that it's more. It's a scholarly mm-hmm. work essentially. And to me, one of the things that's interesting about that is I don't know what people make of it. Really, I mean, and I'm still puzzled. You know that I mean, it. The first time I saw it, I was completely taken with it. But you know, the material spoke to me, and I was fascinated by what the filmmaker was doing. And you know, it's something. It deals with a period which, you know, when I was a kid. So it's completely internalized for me. I don't have to like stretch to see what's going on. And it reminded me of things that I'd forgotten, and so on. And then I saw it again, and I was impressed by how researched, how thought out mm-hmm. it was. But I still don't know who exactly this movie speaks to, like what you have to bring to it. I mean, there was a guy writing about it in Film Comet who loved it and you know said something very hyperbolic, but you know, he compared it to Finnegan's Wake. Okay, so that's like, you know, yes, it's a laughable thing to say, but I understand what, you know, this kind of, you know, we deal in hype.
Sure.
Sometimes what he's saying, I mean, that it was there's so much going on
right.
in this movie but who reads Finnegan's Wake? I mean, so, you know, it sounds great.
Who, unless they're taking a class in it? Who outside the academy?
Or I think you could listen to it, you know, and the music of it would come through. And I think that's probably, maybe that's what works with I'm Not There also. I mean, it is a musical after all. It is drawing on something very satisfying, you know. I'm rich.
Sort of picking up on that, one of the things that you've always done that I've always been kind of impressed and amazed by is your ability to write history by writing about movies. That is, I mean, I think, you know, the example of your book on the 60s is a great one, which is a narrative of the decade told through what is both very straightforward but also very complex method, because you're talking about the circumstances of the movies making and distribution and reception by an audience, but you're also talking about what's in the movies and reading them as very complicated allegories of their moment. It's in a way a very simple question of how, you know, how you came to this way of considering movies, and also how you apply it not only to the past, which is you know, there as an interpretable text, but also to, in a way, the present, which is for the audience, the future that we have to be writing about, you know, every week.
Well, one of the I'm glad you asked this question. But one of the
okay.
One of the great things about movies, and one of the things that's really fascinating and in some ways new about the motion picture medium is that, you know, movies are time capsules, and even the worst, sometimes the worst, best of all, and this is something that actually me and fellow students, you know, used to think about it at Binghamton. I mean, this idea, and I also think that there's a great precedent for this, and in the case of Siegfried Krakauer, and I mean, a lot of what his formulations in From Caligari to Hitler may seem naive in some respects, although not in all, but that for me, this was like a blinding insight when I was, you know, to come across this as a teenager, to say that, you know, that movies really did, you know, intersect in such a basic way with the life of their times and with the whole collectivity. I mean, that it was really a collective form, and even when you had individual artists creating to a degree, they were particularly in commercial films, speaking for large groups of people, and so I think that's to me, this is just intrinsic in the meaning. It's just a natural way to look at it, and I think that again, since Reagan, and David brought him up, I think that Reagan made this obvious to everybody in a way that you know, that we live in this kind of movie structured world, which he so effortlessly could just reference and draw on, and you know.
Do you find when you're reviewing? I mean, because the reviewer's task in some ways is a very straightforward and simple one, and maybe for exactly that reason, one that is sometimes, I'm, you know, speaking for myself, just almost overwhelmingly contradictory in the way that you describe, I think, in that essay. And one of the tensions, it seems to me, and one that you know, I've seen you deal with in very interesting ways, is precisely between, you know, within the very confined space of a weekly newspaper column, to somehow gesture toward or get at that, those kinds of meanings, political, social, whatever, that you're talking about, but also evaluate the thing, the object itself, and come to some judgment on it.
Well, I'm thank you. A week is a lot of time compared to what I mean, to have to turn something around is overnight or in a couple of days is very arduous. I think that, you know, it's a way of experiencing the film, the material, and for me it's different. I mean, I like to review all different kinds of things, and in a way, the beat that I had when I started is, you know, I'm nostalgic for. I don't see as much stuff. I mean, when I saw, you know, Ed Holter's 10 best list in the Voice, I said, oh, you know, I'm really, you know, like, you know, sort of out of touch. But different movies present themselves in different ways, and some things just, you know, they demand a kind of historical response, and other ones, it doesn't come as easily. I mean, a movie like There Will Be Blood. I mean, when I saw it, I just was like lost in the filmmaking of it. It just was great filmmaking in my opinion, and so that was kind of enough to think about. But there are plenty of other movies that don't give you that, and so, you know, it's easier for other considerations to present themselves.
And I think there's also, in the case of that movie, when the initial impact of it wears off, there's an awful lot. I mean, it certainly is not irrelevant to a lot.
Not at all.
That's happening in the moment. I think provides us with an interesting segue to say a little bit about the movie that we're about to show, which was one of your top 10 this year, Day Night, because it seems to me that this is a movie where exactly these two things are intersecting. There is an approach to filmmaking that is quite striking and very accomplished and very just formally interesting. As those of you who haven't seen it will see. There's also a subject matter, if you want to put it that way, that could hardly be more acutely relevant to the mm-hmm. to the lives of Americans, New Yorkers, everyone else.
I think that this is a great example of this. I mean, first of all, Day Night, which you may know, deals with a suicide bomber, terrorist, was first shown in Cannes. I didn't see it there, and I would have had to go out of my way. I think it was shown in the Cannes and something. Just the thought of it. But I did see it, and I was really knocked out by it. And one of the reasons was because this was such. Well, first of all, it's a fascinating film experience, as you know. I mean, it really engages you as a viewer, and the subject matter is part of it. But also, it's the way that the movie is made, and it's the way that the movie is conceived. And this is. In this movie, really, what to me is the most remarkable aspect is this is a movie with a very strong concept. Mm-hmm. I mean, you become aware of it; it's almost like a structural film. I mean, you become aware of the concept very soon into the movie, but at the same time, so it's heady; it's an intellectual idea, but it's a very visceral film. The filmmaking is very you get very very involved in it, and not on a on a cerebral level,
like not that. At all, and in a very, not to say too much about it because it is an experience that you kind of it is best to have sort of in a raw and immediate way. But your emotional connection to it is also very complicated because you're not quite sure what it is you want to happen.
Exactly right. Yeah.
It's an incredible suspense that's created and. You don't know which outcome is the bad one and which is the good one, and that is absolutely horrifying as it plays out.
Yeah, and you've got plenty of time to like become aware of this in yourself. Yeah. To be that's why it's that's entirely true. I would say that there's two short movies before, one of which was kind of a surprise to me. I'm delighted that. That David showed it. It's also 30 years old, as he pointed out. And then there's a movie that I, after that, that I asked to be shown with the Day Night, and that's Square Times, a movie by Rudy Burkhardt, a photographer and filmmaker in New York, and it's a very straightforward and almost artless document of Times Square. Of 40 years ago, 1967, which was a time that I used to go to the movies there quite a lot, and I would consider that part of my education too. So fun for me to see this, but also because I think that it's
exactly the same place.
It brings something, and I just wanted to bring something out about the place because in addition to everything else, Day Night is a great New York movie. It was my favorite New York movie.
Oh, I think so. And in a way, the one of the most beautiful and most authentic and least sentimental. I mean, it's not it's not Sex in the City.
No.
Okay. well, thank you, Jim. We'll. I look forward to our future conversations.
Okay. Always.
Thank you for listening. The Pinewood Dialogues at Museum of the Moving Image are made possible by generous support from the Pannonia Foundation. To learn more about the museum, visit www.movingimage.us.